Well, folks, to the Aries Working Group call for March 30th, 2022. This is a Hyperledger call. And so the antitrust policy and the Hyperledger Code of Conduct are in effect. Please mind those. I will paste the agenda link in the chat. Please update it with anything relevant. And if you'd like your listing on the attendees list as well here, is there anyone new today that would like to introduce themselves?
Hi guys, it's Kyle Robinson. This is my first time to this call. I've been to other groups, but this is my first time to this Aries group. And I'm working with the BC government, closely with Stephen Curran.
That's Stephen Curran guy. No, we're glad you're here, and welcome. Thomas, you unmuted. I don't know if that was on purpose.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, my name is Thomas Diesler. I work with Red Hat, and I reached out to the Aries community because I'd like to integrate the Hyperledger Aries in the framework with our integration framework at Red Hat Fuse, and from the Java side, especially Apache Camel would be relevant here. I'm relatively new to the space, and I've already received a very warm welcome last week from Sam and Stephen, and I look forward to working with you.
Welcome, glad you're here. All right, any announcements besides IIW? The IIW announcement being it's excellent, and you should attempt to attend if you are able. Any other announcements? Any release status or work updates that we want to share with the community?
Lots going on in ACAPI these days. Tons happening. We're trying to wrap up a pile of PRs to put them in the 074 release. Also highlight, we're having good success in using Aries Asia Test Harness. We are sort of doing follow-up when we see changes in behavior tests previously passing that are failing. And we had a incident in the last couple of days where we sent notes to the JavaScript and Findi folks, and the Findi folks responded today saying, oops, yep, something we refactored and didn't get quite right. We'll have it fixed in a day or so. So good things to see the value coming out of that.
Awesome. Okay, so last week we talked about a variety of topics, including the need. Timo talked about the need to prove ownership over a DID as part of a variety of processes, and I had committed to putting together some notes to further discussion on one of those approaches. So I have those notes today, but that's all I have on the agenda. Is there something I was forgetting, or something that we want to add to the agenda today before we get going?
There are a couple of simple PRs that we might look at reviewing if we have time. One of them is an update to the AIP links for 2, where I took into account all of the clarifications on basically just the big changing the primary branch to main in the Aries RFC repo and other repos, and so updated all of the AIP links to use that one. So it's not very controversial, but it probably should get merged.
Okay. Definitely do a PR review. Might even be able to spell it correctly. James?
If there's time, Sam, I have probably a fairly brief discussion topic on revocation notification v2 that I'd like to discuss.
Excellent. And Kim.
Did we want to talk about where we wanted the dictionary compression to move forward with?
Yes, we were going to bring that back up. Okay, we've got ourselves a good list. Okay. Here is are my notes for data ownership. I've got the link in the thing. This is not yet a full fully defined protocol, but I had questions as I dove into this that I wanted to ask the group about approaches and figure this out. So let me describe sort of the basic structure that I was looking for, and then the options and things that I ran into, and then you know, I've got some questions, and of course any other feedback that questions I should be asking but I'm not, I would love to discuss. The basic idea here is that it's useful to be able to prove ownership over DIDs. Two use cases are proving the DID when being issued a credential, with the subject being a DID. This is relevant in JSON-LD credentials, or also proving ownership of a DID presence in a machine-readable governance document, even if the relationship that you have is not using those specific DIDs because you're using pairwise ones. So there's a couple of use cases there. There's only two messages to this protocol. One is a request. The idea there is that you could request disclosure of the other party and optionally specify specific DIDs that you are looking to receive confirmation of. This is basically sort of a gentle start from the other side. The party can disclose DIDs, including not specifically the ones you're asking them about. Maybe they're incapable or maybe they don't want to. But that's there. And then, of course, the disclosure of the DIDs. There's two different strategies here that I'll get to in a second. But the idea here is that I'm saying, here's a DID, and here's proof that I have control of that, you know, via key ownership or exercising the keys that are in the DID, associated DID document. And so that's the basic idea. We've used this pattern in a handful of other places, including feature discovery, and the ability to disclose something without being asked is really useful. And so normally when you are proving something, you sign a challenge, and in that way the attack can't be replayed, you know, out of the context in which it's intended, as a protection. And so I have that kind of mocked up here, but there's a couple of issues or maybe opportunities that I've seen that we might be able to take advantage of. So one of the options is that we can pass a JWT with the claims formed like so. These are all standard claims that align with good usage here. And if I present a JWT with the DID of the prover in the relationship and the audience, the DID of the other party that I'm proving it to, and the subject being the DID that I'm attempting to prove and then also a date time, and then I sign it with a key associated with the DID being proven, then this provides an effective context for the presentation of this. And we may not actually need a unique challenge or a strategy to come up with a challenge because of the sort of the uniqueness of the context that this is being demonstrated inside of. The timeliness of the date time is something that I have questions about, like what's reasonable there, or should we not declare some timeout given that the relationship itself is already part of the claim being presented here. And so that was one of my open questions. The other one is that we have, you know, here's an example where the signature could be passed. This may be better renamed, but the signature would be passed in the form of a JWT here. And this, the DID here is a little bit redundant because it's also contained inside the JWT. And so we may want to eliminate that. The other strategy that we've done here before when we actually want to sign stuff is actually just use attachments because we already have an associated structure for that. And so in this particular case, you could represent the DID that you are proving. There's a challenge string here because this is in the form of a JWS, not a JWT. And this is incorrect here, that the signature would be a JWT here. But the basic idea, even though I haven't done it perfectly, is that we would just use the signed attachments feature and then pass the DID plus the challenge data as a payload in an attachment. That has the advantage of perhaps using other code that already exists that will verify signed attachments. And signed attachments already have the ability to sign it with a different key than is used for the relationship. So when you specify that, you know, it can still be the key associated with the DID that you're attempting to prove. This one feels a little heavier, but has the advantage of reusing signed attachments. This one feels perhaps maybe a little bit lighter, and using a JWT as a sort of a familiar way of doing that. And so those are some of the questions that I ran into is, do we need a challenge? Can we get away with just the context present in the JWT claims that that we could use, or is signed attachments better? That's the problems I have. Any thoughts, comments, good ideas, suggestions?
I think this, it looks pretty nice. And also, not too complex to implement. It's just two messages. Would it be possible for, because that's what I'm thinking, for example, the use case, what I was thinking of is basically you ask the holder to provide the DID. Would it be possible to send a request without saying which DID? Like, I want you to choose a DID, but I just want you
absolutely
to make sure you prove you owe that DID.
Yep. So this is, I didn't fully document this out here, but this is an optional list of DIDs that you can provide. And if we decide that the challenge is not the approach because we're going to go JWT, then that would be gone too. So you'd basically send this DID ownership request and then they would disclose whatever DIDs they wanted to. So totally.
Just wondering, would it make sense for the request to be either instead available as an attachment or as well available as an attachment versus a full-fledged protocol?
We could, but we've run into this issue before where if we do stuff inherent to other messages, then sometimes you need to do the stuff independently of other messages, and that's a problem. One of the things that had occurred to me is that if we do the attachment mode, there's a couple of different things that we could actually do. And we could basically have an explicit protocol, but also a general form of providing disclosures as an attachment. So there's a third door here that I didn't document where we actually use a JWT, but just attach the JWT without an additional signature because the JWT contains it. And what we could do is agree on the form of the attachment, and then you could technically include a DID ownership disclosure, not because you're sending it right within this, but because you attached a disclosure in the form of a JWT in an agreed upon way to basically any message. And that might provide a more efficient way of doing so if you're already in the flow of something. Kim?
I would lean towards having it signed by the DID that you are saying that you have ownership of, because otherwise you could claim ownership of DIDs that you don't have.
So no one's arguing anything contrary to that. There's just two different forms of providing the signature is what we're talking about. One being the attachment signature structure, which is a JWS, or the other one being a JWT, where the JWT is signed with the associated key. So I think everyone's in full agreement about signing using the key you're trying to prove ownership of. Does that make sense?
Does one support the listing of multiple DIDs better than the other?
They're basically both a list. You either attach multiple things or you specify multiple DIDs, you know, DIDs with the JWT here in a list. And so I think it's probably ACES, but I definitely wanted to support the disclosure of multiple DIDs, which Timo could prevent a context problem for you, but let's come back to that in a second. Steven.
So when I was thinking of the attachment, it seems like you've already got the attachment to respond with a proof of control.
Well, there's two. These are alternatives.
My question more was, is there a way to ask for it as well? So you know, Timo's big case is I want to issue you a a W3C verifiable credential, and I need the subject ID to use. So I need a DID to use for that, and I need you to prove that you own that DID. Now, that can be fully implied such that there is no need to formally request it, that no one in the protocol that, oh, you have to disclose ownership of it. Is that sufficient, do we think?
So a couple thoughts. One is that we may be able to do this either via implication, as you've described, or something like a goal code, where you're kind of saying, by the way, you got to tell me which DID you want by proving ownership of it. I'm more nervous to allow the request itself to be issued as an attachment, because we sort of enter this weird world of like implied sub protocols via attachments that I think is a really gnarly thing to go down. We haven't done that.
Yeah, before. I wasn't going down the path of an attachment for that. I meant as another decorator. In other words, did ownership requested.
I think we could probably get away with something like goal codes.
Okay, that's interesting. I like that.
Or we, in the exercising of a protocol like credential issuance, there would be more or less an implied rule. I mean, it's not just totally implied, it's documented. But if you are requesting or being offered a JSON LD-based credential, then you must also attach like a proof of ownership as an attachment to some other message in the protocol. That's a little bit implicit to the point where it's like a little harder for developers to discover. Something like a goal code may be a little bit more explicit there.
Okay. One thing that would imply is that the responder, the one proving DID ownership, they have to know what to sign. And so there's got to be this knowledge of what it is they're signing, what they're taking from the request, whatever it might be, and attaching something. I have to know what they're signing.
So maybe, I think, right? So let me highlight this again. What the traditional approach is to provide a nonce or a challenge that you signed. And the point there is to avoid replaying. One of the things that I realized in exploring the JWT option as an alternative to a challenge, potentially, is that this, if we use these claims in the formation of a JWT, it already naturally constrains the potential representation or reuse of this JWT such that a challenge may not be required simply because of the already constrained context. Which means that you could actually just prove DID ownership within this the context declared here without having to first having received a challenge from the other party, which is a nice advantage of not having to do a round robin there. That was part of my question is that valid? Am I convincing myself of something that isn't true in the pursuit of an efficient protocol? It doesn't, Timo asked, can we do this for a JWS? Does it have to be a JWT? That's what this challenge mode effectively is here. So I had thought about, can we create more or less deterministically a challenge so that if you're not responding to a request, but just simply disclosing something, can you state the challenge string that you've constructed and then a mode of construction? And I explored what that would look like here. And that includes the challenge is basically the same idea where you create a challenge string with the DID of the prover, the DID of the party being proven to, and the timestamp, which is, you'll notice, all present in here except for the actual DID being proven. And then that becomes the challenge string itself. And then of course, when you sign it, you have to include the challenge string and the DID you're trying to prove, which is represented here, even though I don't have this fully fleshed out yet. And so, the idea is you could still do that. The question is whether we want to sort of define a way of doing a JWS or whether we want to just lean on JWT as a method of doing that.
At least how I understand, JWT is a form of a JWS.
It is.
And those fields are that you can use in a JWT, you can also just in a JWS. It's just a JWT is a compact form. So we could just use the same things we would use with the JWT, but still use the JWS site attachment.
Yes.
We just have to say, like, you need to use these specific headers JWS.
Yeah, so it would be like this, where you, you're going to construct the same sort of payload claims that are present in a JW, where am I here? In a JWT, but you're just going to include them as, oh, I did this totally wrong. Hang on. This would go here. And then the signature would go here. So you're right. We could actually just do that as an attachment. Yes. One of the problems, Timo, I think this creates for you is that there actually isn't an indication in these messages of why these are being disclosed. And so being able to specify why they're being disclosed may actually help in the sense that, let's say, for example, you're trying to issue me a credential in a JSON-LD form, and you ask for disclosure, or it's implied that I need to disclose ownership over a DID. If I just send this disclosure message, I could potentially disclose multiple DIDs, and then you have no idea which one to issue to. And so one of the things that may be useful here in either the attachment form or this other stuff here is to include some sort of goal code. I think we could leverage goal codes directly as an indication of this is why I'm providing you this DID. And with the goal codes that line up for DID ownership for issuance, you could specify that when that goal code is employed, either only one is provided, or the first one perhaps in a list is provided, and then that's the one that you use.
You could also apply that to the request as well, if you're going with a, that may not apply to Timo's use case, but having the request indicate, hey, with this goal code, this is for the purpose of issuing you a credential, for instance.
Absolutely. I'm probably going to guess wrong at the syntax of this, but
Timo, I'm curious, in the issuance flow here with JSON-LD, does the offer get the credential offer get sent, and then you would expect to have the DID disclosure and then the actual issuance, or does it work differently with JSON-LD here? I'm just kind of curious.
Yeah, it would work kind of similar, yeah. You send the offer. I think there's two ways possible I'm thinking of. One is, for example, I sent an offer and I also sent a DID ownership request where the parent thread ID matches the offer. And I say, like, I want you to provide a DID, or I could send a credential, for example, with a DID in it, or without a DID, and I as a holder could say, like, hey, I would rather have you use this DID for me and then disclose it. But yeah, the offer will, the DID ownership proving, I think, somewhere between the offer and the request phase.
Got it.
And with it's implied here that the threading would still work, meaning you could specify like a parent thread and that would all still work with this. Sorry, go ahead, James.
To me, you're totally good. I slightly lead towards the more explicit where the issuer will make a request for a DID. followed up by a disclosure, but I am definitely potentially missing context. So that's my take on that, at least. One other thing that I want to...
Go ahead.
Go for it, Timo.
I just want to say, I think I agree with you in that the separate protocol or like the explicit way sounds, I think, nicer to me, because it makes it clearer like that you're requesting requesting it as part for the credential issuance instead of like embedding it inside of a message in an attachment or goal code, or because goal codes could also collide with the other protocols. So I think having a separate protocol to it and requesting it as part of the issuance protocol, I think that would be the most explicit way to do this.
I kind of think that an analogy to please ACK is right or is valid and could be used versus an explicit protocol. I really think it's always going to come, or for the most part going to come in context of another transaction that's already going on, and therefore could be piggybacked onto it. To give another use case that's a possibility, so the one use case I've primarily been thinking about is the issue, and present another one that I can think of is there's talk in the wallet security group that a key created in an enclave that can't be exported would increase the binding between the person and the, or at least the device and the wallet. And so when doing an indie proof, you can provide a signed public key you can include a public key from that pair in the proof. So the issuer puts it into the credential, and then you prove ownership over it as you present a credential. And again, I think, you know, the implied request, that becomes an implied request when you request that particular attribute. You also need to send an attachment or an additional part to your proof that is this proof of ownership of that particular key.
So to be specific, we're talking about DID ownership here, not key ownership, though device binding heavily relies on that. And I'm trying to not merge those concepts.
Okay, you're trying to keep that away from that. Okay.
Yeah. Kim.
I just wanted to make sure that we're thinking that it's not just public DIDs that we might want to prove ownership of.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely all DIDs. Which means that when you specify the DID could, for example, be a DID peer method too, where the entire DID and the associated information for the DID doc is present. And then of course you're going to sign with the linked key the same way. So yes, absolutely.
If this is not just for public DIDs, wouldn't this make this highly correlatable for private DIDs?
Absolutely. The whole thing is highly correlatable.
Absolutely.
Anytime you sign anything, right,
why is this desired then?
Well, the desire is to
understanding.
The desire is to enable correlation. For example, if you have a JSON-LD credential where a DID is the subject, you are trying to associate the DID in the subject with of course the DID that you own and the proof thereof. In the case that you are, one of the use cases for this is proving that you are a DID that's present in a machine readable governance document, for example. So that you're, you know, as a trusted issuer or trusted verifier or something. And so in that case, you're actually trying to be correlated. And so that's actually kind of the point. The expectation is not that this would happen all the time. And this, in fact, is useless or has no function in the case that you are, that the relationship that you're trying to prove ownership for is also the DID that you're using in the DIDCOM connection, because the authenticated encryption that we're using already does that. So this is only used in the case where you're trying to provide or prove ownership over a DID different than the one that you're using for the DID-COM relationship. Does that make sense? So the goal of this community is not to avoid correlation at all costs. It's to avoid systematic correlation by the design of the sort of the base protocol stuff. There are times where proving correlation is actually a desired feature, and that's what we're targeting here. Does that make sense?
Cool. Yeah, I just wanted to I just wanted to clear it up. I wanted to understand what the purpose of this was, but yeah, thanks for clearing that up.
Okay. Yeah. You're totally right, though. That's normally something we try to avoid touching. In this case, we're specifically trying to be correlated by some other identifier. I often think there's of course use cases both ways. This machine readable governance thing, I think, is going to become really useful, but also certainly providing compatibility with JSON-LD style credentials, their method of subject binding. There's lots of reasons why that's not great, but there are some use cases where it is a good idea, and so being able to support those is worthwhile. Any sense of whether we need to use a challenge string or whether we can get away with using a JWT style set of claims to limit the context of its use? I'm leaning this way instead of in erasing the challenge string stuff, but I wanted to see if there's any feedback on that.
Maybe a dumb question here, but would that require the requester or the whoever's challenging to verify the all of the claims, essentially, if that makes sense?
Yes, but you'd have to verify the construction of the challenge string anyway. So the work is not any additional work. It's just in a different form. For example, if I present this to you, you have to validate that this string has been constructed appropriately, or it's subject to be replayed. So if there's an incorrect disclosure did or the other party did, for example, then that's possible to replay. So you've also got to validate and check that no matter what. It's not a hard validation, but it's something that you do definitely have to validate. And so this is basically just validating them as separate attributes, the signature being across all of them, as opposed to sort of validating the construction of the string. And I just haven't written the text about what's required to validate proof of DID ownership yet. Yeah. Yeah.
At least from my perspective, I don't think, I think that should be sufficient, because I think it's essentially just putting the data in a different format, if you will.
Basically, the one advantage of the challenge string is that the requester could provide a customs challenge string if they wanted. And in the JWT sort of form of this, they can't. They're just subject to this. And so that's one of the technical differences, is that you can't provide your own challenge string. Because that could be whatever you wanted.
Right.
And so I'm leaning towards the JWT thing just because of how cleanly it lined up with the context that we're trying to limit its use inside of. The other thing that I'm assuming here is that if you prove ownership of a DID to me, I'm going to like retain that DID ownership proof, so that I now know that this is an associated DID and can use it in my future evaluation of stuff, and that this isn't necessarily something that I have to ask you every single time, although certainly I could. You know, you're likely to be willing to disclose this. You know, for example, if I ask my bank to disclose ownership of a DID that is present in a machine readable governance file, they're likely going to be willing to do that at any point and repeatedly. But I can also sort of cache that information or retain it as something you've disclosed in my relationship. And now that for efficiency reasons or offline evaluation reasons, I don't actually have to ask you for it every time. So James, you like the attachment thing. And so you're arguing for the form as an attachment rather than some independent representation of a JWT. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, because I think based off of my understanding here is then I think that we already have existing code and that'll help with the actual implementation of this protocol.
It'll help with the signature verification, but not any of the other validation that has to occur, but that's semi-normal. So yes, the other advantage is that technically speaking, it gets using the attachment form gets us closer to allowing DID ownership attachments to accompany other protocols, which I think could be a thing in the future. It's a little less explicit to Timo's earlier point, but it's something that could be done. And in the definition of this in an RFC would basically provide the ability to do that too, which could allow other protocols to sort of leverage proof of DID ownership as part of their regular course without having to redefine how that would work outside of an explicit message here. I am a fan of including the explicit message in the protocol here, but I think that the attachment form allows a little bit more future flexibility, not in any way the request as an attachment, but only, sorry, the request as an attachment, but just the disclosure as an attachment. Okay, we've talked about this enough. Are there any final comments before I take a rewrite of this and represent it, having a lot of these questions answered and cleaned up? Excellent. I will go. I'll go do that work and publish it. Timo, I'm going to try to do that before next meeting, so that you have a chance to look at it and kind of see how it stacks up against your desired use case. Thank you. That took longer than I expected. Steven, do you want to drive a PR review real quick? Or shall I? Steven?
Sorry, I was on mute. Yeah, I wanted to drive it, but.
Okay. So you're talking about this one here or this one here? This one here.
Fourth one down.
Okay.
Yeah, so basically you'll see lots of changes, but I put in to the, let's go back to the conversation. So the in the text in the fourth, you know, the second comment there, it actually shows what changed in each protocol that I updated. So what's happened here is the protocols themselves, the readmes in each protocol have evolved since we did AIP2. And because AIP2 links to a direct commit of that protocol, I wanted to get them at least up to date. I wanted to see how many things have changed over time. And then also point the commits to any clarifications that have been done. Basically in this, if you scroll down through this, you'd see the only changes that I've included are basically all of the links to, I believe I did it. All the links change to the new main branch that are used in many repos. So if you look right at the top there, it's showing just, you know, the change to main for the, let's see, what is that? The 03 protocols tic-tac-toe readme. And all that's changed is that the...
So just master to main.
Exactly.
Okay.
And so if you scroll down through these, so anyone that wants to audit what I've done, that's the changes that you'll see. These are the diffs of the actual protocols themselves, the RFCs themselves. The diff you see in the files change is simply that I've changed the commit to point to these later ones. So I don't think this is controversial, but I wanted to give people a background on how I did that. There's a program in the Aries RFC that generates all these diffs based on what the protocol, what the AIP version is in the AIP RFC and what's the latest in the repo itself. Does that make sense?
It does. So to round out the changes, you have changed from master to main and there's two other additions, which is there are implementation table entries. So not a change to the protocol in any way, but just that.
Exactly.
And then you have two links as it relates to 005, which is the explanation of DIDCOM.
Yeah.
Cool. Any commentary or questions about this update that Steven's created? Is anyone opposed to merging this? No one's opposed to merging this. Try to add my review, Steven. It doesn't like me. I will do this immediately after our call today.
Okay. Sounds good.
Okay. Are there other PRs that you want to get to, or do we want to
take a look at, if you could pop into the pull requests? So the ACK one, I have removed the comments about failed, but that's the only one. What I realized was the actual request was to not only do that, but also in the, I believe it's the present proof version 2, there wants to be explicit reference that you shouldn't use an ACK fail. There isn't anything that says you should right now, except it's possibly the drawing. So I haven't had a chance to follow up on that. So maybe we leave this one for one more week and I'll look into that.
Okay.
This looks good though. Because as you say, that's what was asked for.
Right.
I think those are the ones I had. Let's take one more look.
This one was created by Kim, and the update here, this is fun because it's a protocol we're trying to move off of. It's the connections protocol, and one of the mistakes we made there was we included a should here, so a message should be sent after, and that resulted in some implementation differences. That learning has been encoded into DID Exchange as a replacement for the connections protocol. And so Kim is proposing that we go back, even though we're not necessarily going to go update, he's not yet proposing that we update the AIP 1 or 2, but that we update this language to sort of clarify further implementations that may stumble into this. Any other commentary, Kim? Did I represent that accurately?
No, that's a good representation. Old protocols tend to die hard.
I believe that's Die Hard 2. I wish we'd done this like 3 years ago. I think it's worth doing, but I wish we'd done it 3 years ago. This is probably the most asked question we get.
It totally is. Now, we're not necessarily proposing that we update their associated AIPs. They will still link to a previous version of this without some further action.
I still think it's worth doing.
Is anyone opposed to merging this? Again, this does not change AIP 1.0.
I'm not sure what it brings if we don't change AIP 1.0, because now let's say we do it for people that may stumble into this and then start building their agent. They may look at this PR or this RFC, they see must. And so they build their agent expecting the other agent will send the message, but no other agent will do it because all the standards are written, all the agents are written on the shoot. So I think it may create more confusion than it brings any addition at the moment. Like I agree that it should have been there, but as no agent is implemented on this, and if we're not going to change it in AIP, then I don't see the advantage in it.
But perhaps I should rewrite this and say some old agents don't follow this, but best practice is to send. This creates some really interesting grace conditions.
No, we totally understand the gnarliness of this. The fault on this is mine. I wrote that text, but I'm smarter now than I used to be. So the issue, I think Timo's right partially. Anyone that followed the should, as in they are sending that, will not break a change to must. It's the folks that have decided that they're not going to because it's only a should instead of a must that will actually end up with conflicts because of this. Hopefully as our work progresses to move to out of band and then did exchange and fully deprecate the connections protocol, this becomes something that stops coming up. So we do sort of have a sunset here. I think Kim's goal was to sort of just clarify anyway so that people stop falling into this hole. So one of the things that you could do, Kim, is leave it a must, but then add a note that says, previously this was a should, some implementations may not do this correctly according to this. Or okay, another.
I'll go ahead and update it then.
Yeah, cool. Okay. James, you're on deck for revocation notification. What would you like to drive?
Yeah. You can keep it. I don't have anything to show. So
okay.
One of the things that we've come across is that as we've been implementing revocation notification v2, which is actually very similar to is pretty similar to revocation notification v1, and I think the first hurdle that we're encountering is that AIP v2 specifically references revocation notification, which is something that we don't necessarily want to use. And as far as we are aware right now, nobody has actually implemented the v1 or are using the v1 protocol. So I think my proposal there is to update AIP v2 to reference the v2 version of revocation notification, especially given its similarity. And so I wanted to voice that question to see if that causes major headaches or if there's concerns there that we haven't necessarily thought of.
Stephen, are you back or are you still stepped away? He might still be stepped away. Is anyone so what James is proposing is that we update AIP v2 to reference revocation notification v2 instead of v1. V1 had a bunch of issues which motivated the creation of v2. And James is proposing that we update AIP 2 to reference V2 instead. Has anyone here implemented revocation notification V1?
Hey, Sam, it's Regis. I have a tour. I was looking to those two RFCs and I agree they're very close. V2 builds on V1. I think, and Timo saw it pretty much, but I think you and I were talking about this in the last few weeks. I think you were mentioning there may be an implementation of V1 in ACAPI. I don't know if it's being used, but that may be the only implementation that I'm aware of.
I will note, yeah, ACAPI has implemented V1, okay. Although I will note that the current implementation in ACAPI does not actually conform to the V1 RFC. So
okay. It was more an attempt to make it work. Okay.
Yeah.
So just some, so I'm not objecting. I think I agree with the line of thinking based on what I know as well.
James, I think this, I don't hear any objections here. I think the next step is to actually make a PR to AIP v2 that actually does this, and that will be the sort of the final thing to debate.
Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense. I figured before I created the PR and did all that, I would check to see if anybody was already concerned before I did all that. So I will take those next steps. Thank you.
Awesome. Okay, next on the list is dictionary compression. This was specifically of QR codes and invitations. This was something Kim presented a couple of weeks ago, and we were going to come back around to talk about it. Kim, any commentary you want to add?
And so my question is this something that we move forward specifically for generating QR codes, or do I just write up a concept to preserve the knowledge for future use cases?
Any thoughts or feedback? I will note procedurally that the creation of a concept RFC doesn't preclude a feature RFC if we decide to update that. And so it's maybe useful to do both. I think that the knowledge of this technique would be incredibly useful to have in the RFC repository, regardless of whether we do it as a update to QR codes or not.
I will go ahead and write up both the concept and the feature, and then make the pull request for those. And
if you submit them as separate PRs, that's easy to merge one without the other if it shakes out that way.
Yep, I'll go ahead and do that then.
Awesome. Cool. We are about out of time. Are there any further comments or questions or pressing things that you would like to be on the agenda for next week? James, your hands up.
I've got a quick question from working through implementing DID exchange and out of band in AFJ. With one of the things that with the connections protocol is we very often will follow up the connections protocol with a trust ping to indicate that the message is, or the connection has been established. Since that is a protocol that's stemmed off of the connections protocol, should it have the parent thread ID of the connections protocol?
Kim, do you have an answer? Is that another question?
That was another question.
Oh, so you're asking James if we need to have an associated parent thread ID to the connections protocol for the trust ping message. Correct. This is likely an implementation question. Has anyone implemented it one way or the other, meaning relying upon that parent thread or not?
Pretty sure we've implemented it in Akapai by implementing the parent thread.
So you have used the parent thread on the follow-up trust ping.
Hold on, a follow-up trust ping. Sorry.
This is at the end of the connections protocol.
Yeah, sorry, I don't know.
I don't know either. I suspect not, James. But I don't have any evidence in front of me to that. You could always just do it, and I don't think it's going to harm someone that isn't expecting it. If they're ignoring the parent thread or it's not used in that particular case, I don't think it's going to hurt anything to indicate the parent thread.
That makes sense to me. I think one other quick thing I would highlight here is that was not immediately clear to me was that the connections V1 implementation needs to be updated when using out of band to include the parent thread ID based off of out of band, which makes sense, but isn't maybe immediately clear when implementing.
If you see a needed update there, then please make a PR for that. That's often, there's probably going to be a very quick thing, and then we can clarify. Kim, was this a question or a suggestion for next week?
Question. Have we done anything in the community to handle rate limiting max number of messages on a mediator and retry type events?
It has come up for discussion, but there's been nothing documented about it. And I don't recall obvious outcomes of those discussions.
Awesome.
Cool. We're out of time, folks. If you have stuff you'd like to talk about, please ping me and we'll get on the agenda. Grateful for you being here and hope your week is a great one.
Thanks, folks.